Thank you so much for listening to Urbanistica podcast. I am Mustafa Sharif, an urban planner, and you're more than welcome to join my big journey of exploring the making of smarter and more livable cities. Please don't forget to follow Urbanistica on the different social media platforms, and also let's connect on LinkedIn. Big thanks to Urbanistica podcast partner, AFRI. AFRI is an international engineering and design company providing sustainable solutions in the fields of energy, industry, and infrastructure. Are you ready for a new episode? Let's go for it. Today we have a new episode and we have a great storyteller. I have the pleasure to welcome you, Bram, to Urbanistica podcast. Hello and welcome.
Thank you, Mustafa. Happy to be here.
How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm busy, like probably most of the people in our in our field these months, but yeah. I'm very happy and very thankful.
Yeah, it was how many months since we met in Torino last year?
Probably 6-7 months, huh?
Yeah,
when we
yeah.
met in Satosferica, yeah, festival.
Yes, so I'm really happy that we managed to book this time and to record. I love to hear your story, and we have a lot to talk about. So let's start with Urban Foxes. Take us back in time and tell us, like, how did you get the idea and how did you start it?
Yeah, I'll have to take you back to the spring of 2012, to the center of Brussels. At that time, I was doing a master's on top of my part-time teaching position. And when I left the house, like always, I took the local newspaper.
Yeah.
And because the metro had a delay, I started reading an article. And this article was an open letter from a philosopher who was instigating people to take action because things were going way too slow on a matter of sustainable city building,
yeah.
Public space. And this was a philosopher trying to kind of activate people to take action. And he referred to the 1970s, where he also took action himself as a younger guy.
Okay.
And he did an organized sit down in one of the most beautiful squares in Europe, the Grand Place in Brussels, which at that time was still a parking lot. So he picnicked there and he asked us to do the same. And I felt that I needed to do something. And I created a Facebook group just for eight people. And after an hour, I opened my laptop again and I had 2,000 notifications. So this is actually what I always have to tell, because this is where I entered the conversation, the urban conversation, to say. And then, to make a very long story short, we met with some of these people.
Mm-hmm.
And 2 weeks later, we took the street, which is called the Ansbach Boulevard, which at that time was accommodating 20,000 cars per day. And we just blocked the street by by eating our sandwiches. And it was an amazing moment because it was disobedient, and we saw with all the people present that there was a societal need for this and a wish. And the crazy thing was that the next day we were featuring in all international newspapers, China, Mexico, Wall Street Journal, and this is where it really started. And we continued this kind of disobedient movement for 3 years, and we managed to push through quite a lot of important dossiers.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we also felt we were coming to kind of a burnout, because as an activist, you always push and you always react.
Yeah.
So we also wanted to do something more proactive, and that's when we started the NGO. At that time, we had no clue what kind of activities we were going to do. We started with a very simple urban intervention, which we called the pop-up pétanque, where we could open the pétanque, the game, the French game, on every urban setting. So basically, we could turn a parking space into a space for play. And this is where we kind of started. And to make the story a bit shorter, in 2014, we were connected through a good friend of ours to the Erasmus Plus program.
Yeah.
And that was the time we started organizing one European project per year on top of our work.
Mm.
So, yeah, one thing led to another. And now since 2 years, I am working professionally for Urban Foxes. And at this moment, we're trying to build more capacity to expand the team and to have an even bigger impact on our cities.
Yeah, yeah. It's a great work that you did with the team during these years. And here we love like long stories, not long story short. So I will take you back. Tell me, what were you teaching at before you get involved into this urban development world?
Yeah, before I got involved in the whole urban activist scene,
yeah,
I was teaching in secondary school. So okay. I was teaching languages, Dutch and English.
Yeah.
And well, to be fair, I didn't really have a thing with cities. I knew I loved traveling.
Yeah.
And somehow I also felt that there was something wrong with Brussels, but I couldn't put my finger on it.
Okay.
Yeah. And so for me, this kind of 2 years of urban activism and working in this kind of team with urbanists, communication experts, architects, I learned a lot. So it was kind of a crash course for me into this field.
Yeah, yeah. And like also this moment when you open your laptop and you see like 2000 notification, how was your reaction about this?
Yeah, first I thought it was a bug because I had never seen this this symbol because it said 2K.
Yeah.
So 2000. And the issue was that it was a private group. So I had to manually accept all the requests. Yeah. So it was kind of a surreal moment. So this moment was kind of really engraved in my brain as a turning point.
Yeah.
And also the moment where we started seeing that we were featuring in newspapers,
media
globally. Yeah. So these are kind of two crisis moments, a good crisis moment, but there were crisis moments in my life. Yeah.
Yeah. And Bram, when you have this huge number of people, how do you organize? How do you like communicate? Because also I imagine like when we have activism, a lot of people have a lot of energy and want to do things. At the same time, you need to organize them somehow. So how was this part?
Yeah, definitely. So in the beginning, we had to kind of create a new narrative and an urban imagination. So what we first did 12 years ago, we were still very basic with Photoshop. We created a flyer where we kind of took away the cars on the simulation and we added more green. So this was the first part, building a narrative. And the next step was to invite people to set a time and a date. And it was very simple. At 12 o'clock, come to this place in front of La Bourse, in front of the stock exchange, and bring your sandwiches. So it was a very low threshold. And I think the success of the whole movement was the simplicity, but also the positivity. We didn't ask people to shout. We didn't ask people to riot. Okay. It was very, very convivial. So I think this was the main part. And along the way, people started being creative. Some people brought a barbecue, a pizza oven. They started playing games. So in the end, it was more about us facilitating it, making a framework, and the people could fill in how they wanted to claim this public space.
Yeah, yeah. And how was the reaction from the city, the police, and so on? The number is huge. The place is important.
Yeah, the reaction, I have to say, was pretty positive. The people from the information, from the intelligence section, because we dealt with them negotiating,
okay.
They felt that our intentions were very positive, that we were not there to create chaos. It was more claiming our right. So we always, from them, got authorization without asking it. So
okay.
We always said we don't want authorization.
Yeah, yeah.
It's our right to do so, but they always kind of gave us a window from 12 to 2 to picnic, but we always went over it. because we thought it's also all right. So it was a kind of a game of cat and mouse.
To say. Yeah. Amazing. And so Urban Foxes, why you call it, like, why Urban Foxes? Why not like urban, I don't know, activism or change makers, something like this?
Exactly. That was our first, our initial thought when we were brainstorming. We were thinking about very complex names like Urban Response Squad and working with abbreviations. And it did somehow it didn't feel right. Huh. And at that time, when we're kind of stuck, there was a news article saying that there were more and more foxes signaled in Brussels. So actual urban foxes. And the title said Urban Foxes in Brussels. And I thought, after reading the article, this is actually what really defines us. Foxes are sometimes pushed out of their habitat.
Yeah.
They're also very resourceful. They're cheeky. Mm. At the time, we were also activists and pretty much cheeky and a bit bold. So I thought at that time, the name not only sounded cool, but it was also part of our already fixed DNA.
Yeah. It's super, as you mentioned, super cool, but also like it's in your DNA. So super cool name. And also like you call it like urban pedagogy. What is this about? Like,
yeah, I think urban pedagogy, to explain it to you, the way how we see it, has multiple layers. Mm. The most simple layer is that we want to teach as many people as possible about the built environment. This is the very easy layer.
Mm.
Why do we think it's important? Because so far in traditional education, there is not so much interest or focus on these things, apart, of course, in university. But in high school, primary school, this is not such a thing. So we believe it's very important that as many people understand how the built environment works.
Mm.
Why do we think that? We don't believe in participation as such. That is, it shouldn't be a punctual activity. Participation shouldn't be about asking person A about the color of the benches.
Mm.
You want people to co-create, but we also want people to be informed. So there you have friction.
Yeah.
People who are leading a project are often professionals.
Mm.
They're asking people to engage in this co-creation process, often unpaid and often in their free time.
Yeah.
So what we try to do with urban pedagogy is we try to both involve people in the co-creation process,
mm-hmm.
but also teach them about this process and about the city in a way that is fun for them.
Mm-hmm.
Why is this important? Because you cannot expect people to come after work to a boring participation meeting.
No.
And to give you an example, I have never been to a participation meeting. And I'm a white, middle-class, urbanite. Mm. So we want to reach people that will normally not go to this place. So what can you do? You go to people, you close a street with or without permission. I think in a participation process with permission. You focus on what you share with people. It can be music, it can be food, it can be play.
Yeah.
And then you try to engage these people in maybe a bit more workshops with a bit more content. What is air pollution?
Mm.
What are the numbers about cars? What are the facts about cars? What is climate change? What is flooding? So these things we see as urban pedagogy, connecting people to the urban realm through non-formal methods.
Yeah. So it's also like your way of rewarding them, not only like taking data from them as how we usually do in this kind of participation workshops. We just like go to them, we don't know them, it's first time we're meeting them, and then we try to take as much data as possible, then we just say goodbye. So this is your way of like a kind of reward to them, right?
Exactly. The reflex we have, either we work with kids or adults, we always think, what's in it for them?
Mm.
And what's in it for them can be a fun moment. It doesn't always have to be money. It can also be food. It can be a valorization. But if you really want to take these people from point A to B with you,
yeah,
you want to empower them. And I think empowering people, giving them extra knowledge or facilitating them getting knowledge themselves, I think this is a very good way to create ownership with these people in the long run.
Exactly. And like this co-creation became unfortunately a buzzword, like just like sustainability and all the other words. And in the way we work, I work same as you, like in this community engagement processes and so on. And we have to use this word. But as soon as somebody can hear it, they become a kind of negative. What is your reflection about co-creation become like a buzzword and people are not really happy with it?
Yeah, I think the reason why co-creation on some levels has become or has received a negative connotation has different explanations. I think one explanation can be that the people who project to do participation, they lack a certain amount of either competences or a sufficient budget. And I will explain this a bit more.
Yeah.
When I look at people working in the built environment, these can be placemakers, urbanists, sometimes these people are actively involved in a participation process, which you want these people to be because they're professionals. But often these people have not received adequate training in these matters. If I talk now to interns that I have from Urban Studies, during the 4 years of training, participation sometimes is 1 hour class. So one lesson in 4 years. So wow. How do you expect that these people have the competences to facilitate co-creation sessions? So one solution could be either you work in multidisciplinary groups that you let the urbanists work together with someone with pedagogical skills, a teacher, an educator. So this is one solution. Or another solution is to put more emphasis on this co-creation part, the creative, the fun, the facilitation into the curriculum of the urban studies. This is also something that we're trying to do at this moment through different projects. And another thing that's important, I think, is that these participation processes, especially when they are embedded in an official framework, let's say official governmental projects, that this participation process has a clear and sufficient budget to be spent on participation. The reality is still that participation is valorized less than building materials. So yeah. I think these are two important things. One, the competence the people need to have that engage in the participation. And the other one is the budget.
The budget. But when it comes to the competence and skill development, who is responsible to do that? Is it like the individual person? Or is it like an institute? Who is the main responsible, let's say?
Yeah, that's a very difficult question. Because somehow it was sheer luck that I got involved in this process. And it's also sheer luck that I have 22 years of educational experience. So I bring this with me. And this is a very uncommon profile to have in urban jobs.
Yeah.
So you could say that there could be informal education, more attention, for example, in the urban studies department, that there is more attention to this these competences. Or, and what I see more and more happening, there are companies that are offering these courses to professionals, sometimes at a very high cost, because placemaking is very, very interesting and very cool.
Yeah.
You have to ask yourself, what do we want? Do we want to be inclusive? Do we want to make it possible for all people to get these competences? Well, then you need to either offer them free or in an affordable way, or offer them in a kind of more formal curriculum. But I think there can be different actions from different stakeholders. The government can invest, education can invest. And then also as a person, you can also develop your skills by self-development. There are a lot of interesting things, doing a voluntary internship, etc.
Yeah. There is a lot of, like, on the personal, at least what I know at the personal level, there's a lot to learn, like webinars to watch, articles to read, and, you know, like, taking a lot of information just by, like, reading or hearing, and then trying to implement or practice in the normal projects. Talking about the projects, tell us, like, some examples of Urban Foxes. What do you do?
Well, we work both internationally as locally, and for us it's very important. We don't want to be another NGO just doing European projects. So we have a few local projects. One that I'm very proud of is the Academy for Urban Action.
Mm-hmm.
And it's actually a do tank for young people between 16 and 24. And these young people, they work as a kind of living lab that we have designed, and they choose the topic themselves. So this is very important. And secondly, they work in 8 weeks, going from beginners to more experts, and to co-create a prototype. So these young people also get participatory budget to create innovative output.
And how do you select the young people, and is it like the lab, is this something physical?
Yeah, so we found these young people by different media, different calls. So sometimes a friend through a friend, or it was posted on a website or in a newspaper. And in the end, we had like 25 youngsters in the beginning. And then I don't remember the question.
Is the labs some like a physical place?
Yeah. So initially we were kind of homeless as Urban Foxes.
Okay.
Due to the very high real estate prices.
Okay.
So we always went in residency with a partner. Mm. So this could be a theater or a cultural center. And this was our home for 8 weeks.
Mm.
Obviously, because it's the built environment and the urban, a lot of the activities took place outside.
Yeah.
Yeah. But now, since 3 weeks, we have our own space, 500 square meters in the North Station, which is our office, but also our urban lab. And now the activities of the Academy, they are hosted there in our incubator, which is called Track.
Yeah. And Bram, you mentioned that you don't want to be another nonprofit organization applying for a European fund or something like this. Why you don't want to be another one?
Well, we do apply to European projects, and European projects are also our main source of funding. So we believe that there is a lot of good things to be won there. One thing is that you can remain critical towards the local policymakers, because, the person who feeds you, you cannot criticize too much. So we want to remain critical, and that's why 80% of our funding comes from Europe.
Yes.
But we also see that it is very important to be also rooted locally. Mm. Otherwise, you're just maybe a think tank, an umbrella organization. And we believe it's important to connect the local needs to European thinking. And this is actually what we really love to do, is that we enjoy very much to think on a kind of a more meta level together with other European specialists, universities, policymakers, other NGOs in placemaking. But at the same time, it's also important that we facilitate young people to grow in this context. So through these European projects, we can also send young people abroad. We can give young people and also professionals the experience to learn about placemaking. So what we were talking about before, we organize these kind of training courses and design labs for young people, professionals, policymakers, but they're always free of charge. So instead of charging people 3,000-4,000 euro for a placemaking course, we are able to do this for free thanks to European funding. So this is what I mean, that we don't want to be another NGO just applying for projects. We think it has to be rooted locally, and it also has to have an impact locally.
And is the focus or the target group of Urban Foxes are the young people?
The young people are one of the focus groups. Mm. So we believe in our mission statement that cities should be sustainable, inclusive, and co-created with a focus on often neglected stakeholders. Mm. And I think young people are very much part of these often forgotten stakeholders. So our focus until now has been very much on young people, mm. but we also see the need for intergenerational projects. So we see that sometimes a teenage boy would like to maybe do an activity with his dad or his mother. Mm. So we're also looking forward now, because now we have the space to organize more and more intergenerational projects. And I cannot say too much about it, but our dream is to also implement a citizens' laboratory in our space to create this kind of intergenerational, intercultural reflection, but also doing in an urban environment.
Yeah. And when you work with different groups and different projects, you need to, how to say, to change the methodology, the workshop tools, and so on. Because like what I see from my observation and work, a lot of organizations, usually they have one type of methodology and one toolbox that they try to use in every workshop. It's because like they save a lot of time and money and so on when you have they have a standard tool. At the same time, in my opinion, it's not really working like this when it comes to like community engagement. You cannot use the same toolbox everywhere. Of course, it's saving your time and money, but I'm not sure if this is it fits to different groups. How do you do in your case? Because you have also these different type of workshops and people and aims and stakeholders.
Yeah, I totally agree. When I first started looking into different existing tools, I saw a lot of tools that were made by architects, by urbanists, and sometimes also for these people. I thought they were very complex, and I didn't see how young people could use these tools. I'm also thinking about this X made by PPS, which is very relevant, but it is not custom made for young people. It's not really usable for young people. So that's when we start exploring how can we create tools that young people can use and are fun. And we have several examples, and this is also something I can share with you and the listeners in a few weeks. We have created a Placemaking for Inclusion cookbook with 15 recipes. So everyone can start cooking their own placemaking activities. So these are often very simple, very fun, very catchy. And the lesson I learned during my 10 years of placemaking is that when a tool, a method, or an activity works for young people, it's also very fun for the adults. Everybody likes to play. I think if your method and tool has fun and game, the game element in the methodology, I think this works for everyone. To give you an example, probably the simplest tool we have created, and most of the tools are created together with youngsters or through chance. And I think you also will agree with me that an obvious question an architect or an urbanist will ask people is, how would you improve this place, right? This is a very standard and maybe sometimes even cliche question. Well, when we asked this question to some of our young people, these young people completely closed up. They said, how am I supposed to know? I'm not an architect, I'm not a professional. So you find yourself at this moment, a participant, a young person, reluctant to answer this question or to proceed in the process. So to kind of get this person over this reluctance, most of the time because of insecurity, we ask this person, well, if you don't feel like creating a better place, why don't you make this place even worse? So, and at that time, I remember this girl, she completely opened up. She saw the fun in this activity and she started creating the hell. And this is when we created the heaven or hell scenario.
Okay.
And this is a very simple template. You just kind of make a white paper, heaven and hell. You can also project it on an existing place. You can kind of put this template over an existing square.
Yeah.
And then let the young people go wild, either through pencils, collage, Photoshop. And as a professional, with this information from the hell scenario, you can very much extract the information to an ideal place. So these are a few things that we have invented. We also use card games. But it's true that some of these things, some of them you can repeat pretty easily in other contexts. Mm. Other more complex tools, you have to make tailor. You have to tailor make them.
Okay.
To give you an example, in one of our training courses, we developed the urban conflict game, which is a role-playing game where you become someone else. So imagine there is a square and the stakeholders are the owner of a cafe, a mayor of the city, a young skater, a teenage girl, and a police woman.
Yeah.
You have to become one of these stakeholders. But if you want to make it worthwhile, you also have to make a context and an analysis. So you have to adapt the whole game and the scenario to the existing place, maybe give some history, maybe give some context. So it's true that if you work on territorial things, it's good to adapt. And this, of course, takes a lot of time.
Exactly, exactly. But I think maybe we shouldn't save time on this. I mean, save money on this because we have to invest and make it and customize it, no?
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. I also think that nowadays with all the different digital tools we have, even the Canva tools, it's very easy to share knowledge. We once made a city expedition for young people with different assignments. And by just changing the map and the location, you can easily reproduce this activity. We shared this with a partner in Norway, with a partner in Germany, and a partner in Italy, and they all enjoyed the activity. So I think placemaking is also very much about sharing.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Bram, you work with teaching and this pedagogical way of telling a story and information. On one hand, like there is an opinion about young children or young people should get the tough way, should learn and should get closer to how we professional works. On the other side, no, we professionals should maybe simplify the information of our method so it can be easier for the young people to be part of. So where is the limit and the boundary? How can we think there? Because they should also learn about cities and how the processes are complicated. At the same time, we don't want to scare them.
Yeah, exactly. I think the solution is in bringing both worlds together. And I have a nice story about that.
Tell me.
A year ago, I was contacted by the Flemish government and they still had some budget and they want to do something very revolutionary on a youth participatory way. They wanted young people to write a project call and evaluate the projects with a total budget of 200,000 euro.
Whoa. This is crazy.
But they also understood that it's very unlikely to just go out there, select random young people and give them the money.
Yeah.
So it needed to be facilitated. These young people needed to be coached. So this is when we applied for this this kind of trajectory coaching. We won, as one of the three applicants, we won this project. And now we're in the final phase. And we went through around 10 workshops where we informed these young people, these judges about the goals of this project. One important goal was that the projects that were applied were youth participatory and were fun. So in the end, these young people have to decide if they would like to join these projects or not. And what I think was really valuable, and to answer your question, two of these sessions were in collaboration with people from the administration, experts dealing with project calls, experts dealing with these kind of more formal criteria. What we did is we created a workshop where we brought these often boring criteria into the world of the young people. And we used the quiz, we used different methodologies. And what we saw was that the adults really enjoyed to work with these young people to share their knowledge. It was also fun because they were kind of ripped out of their normal habitat, which is maybe more an office space, into a more fun environment. And these young people were also very happy because the people were listening to them. The adults were listening.
Yeah.
So for me, this was one of the most magical moments of the last, let's say, 12 months, because I really saw the power of bringing two different worlds together. And this moment, so tomorrow and the day after tomorrow, 15 NGOs, schools and organizations will pitch their ideas to the young people, and the young people will give feedback.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So this is actually somehow an answer to your question, because I believe we can bring these worlds together, but we have to curate them. We have to design, and not design in a graphic way, but design the educational processes to bring these two worlds together.
Exactly, like this, to create this kind of space for different groups to meet and to agree about one common thing. And I think this is a lot to do with facilitating these two groups. And the outcome they will decide about. They should talk to each other and decide it, right?
Exactly. So it's about facilitating these these places, either physical or even digital. And that brings us kind of to the methodology of Living Labs. I think when designed well, Living Labs can be the solution to a lot of our issues that we have in the urban environment.
Yeah. Bram, do you believe strongly in the digital tool or no, the physical meeting is the king?
I think we have left the phase that we overemphasized the smart city. I think we all agree that digitalization or technological solutions alone will not save the planet or save our cities. I think, of course, they can help. When it comes to apps and tools, I think they are still very expensive to produce. And I think it's very hard to compete with the likes of PlayStation and Xbox, which is the world of our young people.
Yeah.
Young people will often see these apps as simplistic and very basic. I still believe that, especially after COVID, and the more and more isolating world we're living in, I think it's very good to really go out on the street, not only use Minecraft, like I see a lot of the times, but really go out, let young people and people experience city at eye level, because I think we need to move away from planning bird's eye perspective, top-down planning. We need to go really to the street and think about how cities should look like for people, young people, children, senior citizens, and also for the future generation.
Yeah, I think also it's important that people understand what we work with and what is the city development or placemaking about. It's like being outdoor and one-to-one scale, you know, like really touching the things, decorating, constructing, and so on. Of course, the digital and the sketches is important, but I think for them to get the best feeling and the best experience is when they are outside in the physical place, because we are talking about this physical place, and working there or talking there and doing activities there. I see it from like the workshops I did here in Sweden. It's much, much rewarding if we take people outdoor in the place that we are talking about, instead of sitting in a cafe and sketching and or showing PowerPoint or digital tools and so on. It's the output is so much different.
Yeah, exactly. I think people, especially in the initial phase, I think people need to experience a public space. It will also increase their imagination to reshape this place. Mm-hmm. It reminded me of a project we did co-creating urban furniture. We did a whole process with young people, and we even asked them to keep an as diary. An as diary, meaning that they had to keep a diary and take down during a week the different places they would sit on and why they would sit on it and the good things, the bad things. And from that experience, you can really, as a designer, go to work. And of course, there you have your digital phase, but it's important, I think, to go back out there. Mm.
Mm. And in the podcast, usually when we talk about this best practices, what we do and so on. I try to reverse it, the question here, and ask what should we stop doing? So I ask you, we as a placemakers, what should we stop doing when we work on projects?
What should we stop doing? Well, one thing, I think we should stop focusing on just ourselves. I think it's important to market our organization, our company, because this is how we get interest or employment. But I also think in our work, we should really try to think inclusive. I have seen also placemaking becoming a buzzword and also being used by real estate development. Mm-hmm. So what I think that we should stop doing is to only think at the financial value of placemaking. And then I would also think about policymakers who often think about the city branding and the value of their city. So I think we should go back to the drawing board and see, well, who are the founders of placemaking? And then I think about our godmother, Jane Jacobs, which was a fierce activist. And well, we really need to try to include as many stakeholders as possible. And so what should we stop doing? Well, we should stop doing boring participation meetings. This is one thing we should stop doing. I think nobody would like to go to a participation meeting.
No.
And often in a setup with the policymaker on a stage and the people below. We should really stop creating or facilitating hierarchy.
Yeah,
I think this is one of the things I see.
That's true. And what are you expecting? What is happening? What's on your agenda for 2024 related to
what's
urban
happening?
Foxes?
Yeah, a lot of question marks because, like always, you're waiting for results. But there are a few exciting things coming up. One is, of course, our social incubator, our urban lab track. For the people who speak Dutch, it's called een broedplaats, which is literally kind of a place where to hatch your eggs. and it's a shared space for now with other partners. And the goal is to open this place as a semi or completely public space. So this is the wish.
Yeah.
Another interesting and exciting project is our first Creative Europe project, which is called New Inherit. And there we will try with all our amazing partners to adapt and rethink our heritage spaces and reflect on how we can give them back to the community.
Okay.
So how can we use unused or underused spaces and give them back to the community for creative entrepreneurship or culture? So this is another exciting project. And the third one, it's about how can we create change in the curriculum of urban studies.
Which level? University?
University, yeah.
Good.
So it's a collaboration between, it's a higher education European project. And we're going to implement the Living Lab methodology into the urban studies curriculum, at least in a few universities. So we're going to try to bring together students of urban studies in a living lab model together with citizens, policymakers, knowledge institutions, and companies.
Yeah. Is it the urban lab of Urban Foxes, or you create a new one?
So for this last project, it's a living lab, and this living lab is more like a framework that can be implemented in different places in Europe. But our living labs will be mostly implemented in our incubator in Trek, and also in the place where it started from me, on this Ansbach Boulevard. Behind it, there is La Bourse, which was unused, and now we will also have the kind of the metaphorical keys to use this place as an incubator.
And tell me, when is the recipe book coming out?
Well, the recipe book has been delivered already to the European Commission, but we are planning to disseminate and to spread the links to all the placemakers in a few weeks. We want to make a few changes. And, and they will be available for free, of course.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That's awesome. So a lot of things going to happen during this year.
Definitely. Yeah, I'm looking forward, and I'm also looking forward to create more impact. And apart from all the work, also have a bit of fun, because 80% of the work is behind the scenes. I really want to work again with the young people and really do workshops. Yeah.
How many foxes are you now?
Well, at this moment, I'm the only one officially on the payroll.
Okay.
So, we also have a paid intern. We also have freelancers, and we have a lot of volunteers and young people. As a small NGO wanting to keep their independence, we also don't want to take it too fast. We don't want to take projects that go against our DNA. So we don't really collaborate a lot with real estate agencies. So we want to grow sustainably and healthy. But of course, in 2024, we would really look at expanding our capacity and to hire more people. But one of the things that make it difficult is the very high cost in matters of tax in Belgium. And this is something that really makes it difficult for NGOs to expand their team. To give you an idea, if we manage to get in 100,000 euro funding, if you want to hire someone, you only keep 35,000. So 65,000 euro goes to taxes.
So it's like disappears.
It goes to the social security.
Of course, it comes
pension.
Back somehow.
Yeah,
but like back, from this project, it disappears.
It does, yeah. So this is quite the challenge to grow in a country as Belgium with these high taxes, is that an NGO has to comply to almost all the same requirements as a company.
Yeah, as a corporate company.
Yeah, exactly.
And you change your career. How is it going? Like, do you like it? Is it tough? Is it as how you were expecting it? Or
I really enjoy teaching, but at that time it was also getting difficult to combine teaching with all these projects that we were getting and the growing interest of placemaking. So a few years ago, I made the jump, first part time and also part time working for the university. From actually this month onwards, I will start completely full time with Urban Foxes. So
nice. Congratulations.
Thank you. This is a really nice moment.
Yeah.
And I didn't expect it to be this much work and pressure, because if you are on the payroll in a university or a school or a company, you don't see everything that's going on behind the scenes, what you have to do to get the money in, the amount of taxes you pay. So I have to say it brought quite a lot of pressure on my shoulders.
Okay.
And this is also the reason why we want to take it slow on matters of hiring more people, because I think this is also very stressful for the person in charge to deal with the future of these people, the future salaries. So you're actually kind of managing people's professional life. They count on you.
Yeah.
On the other hand, what I really, really enjoy about this work is that I manage my own agenda. Together with the board, we choose the relevant topics for the next years. Yeah. We choose our partners because, as you can imagine, it's also important to have good partners.
Yeah.
Partners that share your value, partners that are professional. But I think somehow I was able to create my dream job. But of course, it's never an easy ride. There is always kind of a contrast to things, no? Like a lot of freedom also means a lot of work.
Yeah.
Also, weekends sometimes I have to work. If I go on European trips, sometimes the train is delayed for 6 hours. So, you know, it's exciting. Yeah, it's exciting, but it's demanding.
Exactly. Because now we are moving to the second part of this episode, which is going to be more about you. First part, we talk about foxes and professional work. Now it's more about you to explore more about Bram and your life. So we get also inspiration, especially you change the career and so on. Yeah, so because I have later a question about this moving from comfort zone to another and so on. But first, take us back in time. Tell us more about you, like your childhood, how you grew up, family, and all this time before you changed to this urban development field.
Well, to take you back, it almost seems like another life. a big part of my life, I grew up in a very, very small village without a cafe, without a bakery. More cows than people in the village. And somehow I think as a kid, I was often bored. So it made me also, you know, like deal with myself, play football, go outside, climb trees. And a very large part of my life, I was playing football. So at one moment I was a semi-professional football player. And I was also playing for the national team of futsal in Belgium. So this was due to I think kind of the end of my career due to injury also coincided almost exactly with the time I entered in the urban world. So I kind of also stopped playing football because I wanted to spend more time as an activist. It was taking a lot of my time. So I thought it was time to turn the page and start a new chapter.
Yeah. And what made you become a teacher?
In
this field?
That's a very difficult question. I think like a lot of people when they were 18, I really didn't have a clue what to do.
Yeah.
I had a very good teacher who was teaching ethics. And I was very much interested in the whole philosophy ethics part. So I went to university to study ethics and philosophy, but I quickly understood that I was in it to teach that part. So I went to the teacher training program where I first studied, it was a combination of Dutch, English, and ethics. You could choose as a teacher. And then the first years, I was teaching ethics and Dutch. And then later, I went to do my master's while studying part-time. So I was studying part-time at university and working part-time as a teacher. So this is actually the first part of my life. And then for a very long period, I was teaching in secondary school. With kids age 16 to 19, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, is it the same? Because here in Sweden, I also worked like a part-time teacher. Here, as teachers, you don't get a good payment. It's a lot of headache, responsibility, and so on. So it's not like a super popular role or thing to work with, unfortunately. It's a lot of headache coming out of being a teacher. How was it? Did you also had like challenges there?
Definitely, I thoroughly enjoyed teaching and engaging with the young people. It really gave me energy, even on days when I didn't feel like I went to the class, and these people gave me energy. I also enjoyed a lot of the time with the colleagues. But for me, what is the most or was the most difficult part was the framework and how and all the administrative tasks we had to do on top of our teaching. Often these tasks didn't really seem like useful to me, like filling out papers, agenda, a lot of evaluation based on, let's say, more the boring part. If you get more experienced, you can also turn these things around, because in Belgium, for example, like every teacher, you have to do evaluation, but nobody is forcing you to do formal tests. You can also have an oral exam. You can have a listening exercise. So this was something I was managed to adapt, but it's also very rigid, the system, both on expectations and the things you have to do, but also on your agenda. It's a job where you kind of have difficulty combining it with something else. In my case, in the beginning, I was trying to combine a part-time with Urban Foxes and a part-time with school. And then if you have to travel for Urban Foxes, it's very difficult to be back on time. I luckily had a few nice colleagues who I was able to kind of borrow some time. But let's say that the system and the planning is very rigid. It's fixed it's fixed in stone, and you cannot change this thing.
No. Yeah. No. When you change, or when you move to work with Urban Foxes, you don't feel that you are alone now. You don't know anybody, because I guess you had a big network in teaching world. Now you're like a kind of new here. And how is your relationship with the teachers? How do they see you? You know, you left them.
Yeah, the nice part is that I never really left, in the way that there are still a lot of ways to collaborate with schools and with the old teachers. Now, for example, we're applying together with my old school into a European project. So I can listen to what the needs are of the teachers.
Yeah,
a lot of the teachers also want to expand the experience of the young people outside of the classroom. So that's where we can come in with our expertise with European projects, and also create a project where young people can travel, where they also can create urban interventions. So it's fun that we are locally rooted in Brussels and we're always connected. The European program gives us ways to stay connected to the education.
Yeah. And what do you bring, like, from being a teacher, what skills and things you bring for being a placemaker and urban activist?
What I think I can bring is the realism that when you create activities, that they should be fun. So I can kind of predict which activities, which workshops will work or not. I think this is the biggest expertise I can bring. And I think I also can bring the insight that activities are even more fun when you involve young people in the co-creation phase. So if these activities are made by young people, you have a very good chance that other young people will like it.
How do you predict, when you take a look on a description of a workshop, what things you get like a red flags that this is a boring workshops?
Yeah, when I feel that I wouldn't like it. If I don't like it, a young person also wouldn't like it. If I think it's boring.
Yeah.
And I see it also with my young people. Yesterday we had a meeting with our young judges, and we went through some project applications, and you instantly see their face, like, either smiling or frowning. So I think this feeling is very important. And of course, it's not always easy to convey it to a written document. But, well, one thing, it can be nice on paper, but maybe it's not nice in reality. So I think what is also very important is that as a facilitator, you bring this energy.
Yeah.
And there are a certain amount of tools you can use. You have all the energizers, you have all the non-formal methodologies, but of course you have to bring the energy. You have to enjoy yourself first.
Yeah. You told me, like, when you were teaching, that the kids gives you energy and motivates you to do what you did. What keeps you motivated today to do what you do?
The promise to make impact. I think the perspective that somehow we can touch people, keeps me going. I think what I'm doing, what Urban Foxes is doing, what our young people are doing, is kind of one long, ongoing lobby activity. Yeah. So we really try to weigh on different big or small institutions. To give you an example, last week we were invited with a few youngsters to the European conference because Belgium is the president of the European Council this year, a lot of activities. And if we are able to touch mayors from Portugal, from Bulgaria, if we're able to convince them that youth participation is really important, we are planting seeds. So I think we are planting seeds. It's difficult to know which actual impact you have. But when we see these people opening their eyes, so to speak, this is really what keeps us going. And I think this lobbying exercise can be done in a lot of different ways. One is lectures. One is, of course, social media. Another part is that we really try to also work on the skills of young people, so to make them grow, also professionals. And then in the end, like we were saying, creating these tools that we think are attractive enough for people to work on placemaking. So not just a boring PDF, but also nicely illustrated. We think it's important to kind of connect it to the visual framework we have now with Instagram and everything.
So more like the impact of the projects that you work with motivating you.
Or the promise. I think it's also difficult because sometimes I doubt myself. You know, am I getting a lot? Am I kind of having enough impact? Because it's very difficult to measure. But I think a lot of people in our field are asking themselves this. And I think it's a good thing to ask yourself this.
I think it's important, like, to reflect and see the impact of a project we work. Okay, maybe we cannot see it directly after 1 month or 1 year, but at the same time, we should question, like, okay, when is this going to happen, or which way and how? Because maybe it's like there is no impact, and we think it, we do impact, but in reality, there is no. We just talk and then things disappear, you know? Reflection is very, very important.
Yeah, and we don't know because we're dealing with people. We're not dealing with direct data.
Machines. So
sometimes you think, I go back to our first European project. At the end, we were like, yeah, but did we really impact these people? And we didn't know. But then 7 years after this first training course, we heard that one of the young people became an advisor for the mayor, and he pushed for more bike lanes. So, you know, you never know. And I think what you are doing as well is also, in a way, you are also trying to make a change with this podcast. So I
Like now, how to say, in recording, I don't know, 420 episodes. And my question, like, okay, of course, it's important to talk, to spread the knowledge and so on. But how do I measure the concrete data, the impact? We have listeners from 140 countries and so on. I see sometimes like students writing their thesis or company collaborating with a guest and so on. But at the same time, I don't know, like, how is it going for the others? And I think this is something I should like accept, because we are dealing with people, and it's not like a machine. You program something and then you get the output directly. No one knows how is it going with to be with people. I don't know. Maybe one of them will be the mayor, or one of them will be the architect who is like doing the great change. But I think we should keep spreading this and working with this.
Definitely. I also think that maybe somehow after the Age of Enlightenment and the whole academic research, maybe we have gotten a fixation on impact measurement and data. I think a lot of the things we cannot measure. That's also why I don't believe too much in this kind of impact assessment directly after the project. We have to do it, but we don't know. We can only try. So I think we should move away from this fixation of trying to measure everything and just trying to follow our inner compass. Of course, there are different compasses out there. You have the compass of the human rights. You have the compass of the SDGs. I think these are very important tools as a professional. But I think it's also about your own ethics and your own inner ethical compass.
That's true. That's true. And Ram, you are in love with what you work with, and you're very passionate about it as well. How do you keep the work-life balance? It's important for me and for the audience to hear from different people with a big passion how you control this aspect in life. How do you do that?
Well, I might might offend some people, especially professionals dealing with burnout, but with me, there is almost no barrier between life and work. It's one big ecosystem. And even if I go and have a drink with a friend, it can be or become work. Or if I go to have a coffee or a meeting with who I see as a professional partner, it can also be a nice activity or a nice moment. So the walls and the boundaries are very much blended. They're almost non-existing. Of course, I need to kind of preserve my mental sanity and also my physical sanity. So I try to keep healthy. I try to take breaks, which is not always easy. I sometimes work in the weekend. But then on the other hand, my life is way more... at this moment, there are a lot of contrasts. But there are also quite some moments that things are pretty much quiet or very quiet. And Christmas period is one of them that almost everyone celebrates. Summer holiday is also very relaxed. But then there are months like this, February, March, April, September, October, November, that are kind of a funnel. They kind of funnel everything. And these are things, you have to deal with them. You have to manage them. If I have 20 people coming over from Europe and I'm sick, I cannot cancel it because these people are coming. So to kind of illustrate you that it's not always easy, but for me, it makes sense because I'm very passionate about the topic and my job is not just a job. I'm rooted in Brussels. People know me. I'm passionate about things. I live in an urban environment. I breathe in an urban environment. So for me, they are very much intertwined, these two things.
Yeah. It's like how you told it in the beginning, like in the DNA.
Exactly. Yeah. How can I separate fighting for better cities if I live in one myself? I am constantly confronted with good and bad things in our urban environment. A lot of the people that I know, they also share this wish. So a lot of the talks we have are about these things or about politics, etc. But I think it's normal that we as people dealing with these things, it also kind of gets stuck in our personal life. But there are, of course, moments when I have to force myself to not talk about work.
Yeah, of course, like it's also part of life. But do you think we should all have this kind of work-life balance, that we should fall in love with what we do and there shouldn't be boundaries and so on? What do you think?
I think we need to find out ourselves, of course, what works for us. But I do think, however, that we really need to start way earlier to let young people reflect on what they would like to do in life. Work, hobbies, let them find their talents. And I think a very big part of the issues we have now with young people, but also adults, not finding their path is because of this. Young people, they are educated and trained to process information and to reproduce it on exams. And I think a very big problem is that young people are not confronted with the question, what do you really like? What are you good at? What would you like to do? Is there a way for you to combine what you really love into an economical reality? So I think these are questions that we have to ask our young people in a very early stage.
Yeah.
I cannot think for other people. I don't know if all people have a certain passion. I don't want to assume that. But if we do, it could also be possible that your passion in reality does not really have an economical value. So this is also fine. I think it's fine to really make a big divide. But this is also, I tell my young people and my interns, be aware of the current economical reality. How are you going to pay your rent?
Yeah.
If you can pay your rent or your mortgage by doing your passion, that's amazing.
Yeah. Exactly, because in the end, we are also part of the system. Like, we cannot just like live in a pinky world and just pretend that I follow my passion and this is it. But in the end, we are living in a system, in a city, and you have to pay for the rent, for the internet, and so on. Then you will make a family. Yeah. How is your day? How does your day look like? Like, tell us when you wake up. What do you do? Like your daily routine in a working day.
Yeah. Well, to start, I need to say that I don't really have a routine. I mean, I do have some small things that keep me going, but
yeah,
I don't have a Monday office, Tuesday.
Okay.
So it's really depends on my external partners and my meetings I have. So it can be that like next week we have people over from Europe. Different projects, and they are there a week. So my whole agenda changes completely because of these people. If I have a normal day, which can be online meeting, maybe work a bit on administration, etc., then I like to start the morning with some very good bread that I toast, and I really love jelly with banana. and a very good coffee. Very good coffee. Cappuccino is important for me to start my day.
Yeah.
And then I also like to ease myself into work because I either listen to a podcast or I watch a very simple talk show. And then somehow I ease myself into starting to work. I try to start my day with something nice, like even the foam on my cappuccino can make me happy. Go ahead.
Do you sleep early, wake up early, or?
Yeah, like everyone, sometimes I go too late. But kind of my hour to go to bed is around 12.
That's late, no?
That's late, yeah. It depends where you are,
exactly.
North or south. The Spanish
it's very
will say,
late for us in the north.
Yeah, the Spanish will start eating then.
I remember when we were in Torino, you showed me your Google Maps and you had like a lot of safe places. And I thought they were like beautiful places to visit, public squares and so on. Then you told me it was like a cafe, yeah, right?
Cafes or places where you can have good coffee or nice sweets, nice treats. This is my very, very guilty and unhealthy pleasure. I simply love sweet things, cakes, pastries, pain au chocolat. This is my vice. So for me, it's also a very nice way to explore cities. Before I was together with my girlfriend, I was quite a long time single. Yeah. But of course, I love traveling. So I kind of made my day through visiting different places.
Yes.
I want to see this place. Then I will walk to the other place.
Yeah.
And I started like keeping them because somehow I think with all the traveling I do, I'm very lucky. And because I have to go, for example, to Berlin, to Madrid quite a few times, these places become my home.
Exactly.
And exploring a city through these kind of places, which I often think coffee places have something very cozy. In comparison to, for example, in Belgium, we have the typical cafes, which are very much relying on beer and alcohol. I think these coffee places, they have something inclusive. Okay, you can argue about the price. I totally agree. It's very expensive. But somehow these places have also accommodated other needs for people, like the need to find contact, the need for Wi-Fi and to work, you know, some places have become like co-working spaces. So for me, I started mapping them. And everywhere I go now, I have a bunch of really nice places to have a nice
dream. Yeah. Yeah, it's super fun. So for you, a listener, if you meet Bram one day, like ask him to show his Google Maps and you will like really see how cool is his map with all these bookmarked cafes.
Definitely, yeah. My girlfriend, she even made kind of a, she's an illustrator. She even made a she even made a post. She always draws me as a fox. So she always draws me the fox, and she made a drawing with me in front of a map with all my cakes, and she called me the cake hunter.
This is so funny. Do you, Bram, do you have time for hobbies? Or
I do have time for hobbies. As I mentioned before, I used to play off football. I didn't play soccer for the people in America. I didn't play for a very long time, 8 years because of a serious injury. But then although I was running and I was traveling, I felt the need to play again. Because for me, football is not only physical, it's also playing. So I started again 3 years to play here in Brussels. In a league which is called the Brussels EuroLeague, and we play against different countries.
Countries.
Yes,
wow.
From people, from migrants, from expats. Yeah. And because Brussels somehow doesn't have a Belgian team anymore, I started playing with the UK.
Okay.
Which is also not in the European Union anymore, but
this is so random.
Yeah, and we play once a week against other countries in a league format, and this I enjoy. And the nice part is that we are plenty of people, and we have this kind of app where we indicate when we can come. So even though I am traveling, it's okay that I miss a game. Before it was more difficult, so it's more like come when you can.
Yeah.
So I enjoy football a lot.
That's good. That's good.
And I also enjoy being in nature, going for a jog. I really love good movies and good series.
That's nice.
Yeah, these kind of very simple things. And for the rest, I really enjoy my job. I have to do a lot of things, from ordering sandwiches to creating visuals. So I also think that a big part of my hobby is inside my job.
Yeah, I think it's also because like your job, you do different tasks. You're not only on the desktop and like filling checklist or writing reports. There's a lot of different tasks, and that's maybe makes it a bit more fun, right?
Definitely. I think it's very demanding, and you have to be very generalist. You have to be able to do a lot of different things.
Yeah.
I'm not specifically good at one certain thing, but I am kind of good at a lot of different things. So this is something that also keeps me growing as a person. I study some things, you know, like do desk research, read a lot of things. And then apart from that, I get to use my imagination to create projects, to create outputs, tools. So that's what I really enjoy as well.
Yeah. There are a lot of people, they are in between two chairs, like, and the work and the job they have, at the same time they are looking from the window and they want to do something else because they are not so happy with their job that they have now. What, like, do you have any insight or advice about how can we think in case we start to dream about something else than what we have, and we are not enjoying what we work with, but at the same time it's our comfort zone, we are getting paid, we have a family, but we are not so happy.
Yeah. Something that I think it's important in the scenario just sketched, it's also patience. There is one thing to finding your passion. So I would say to people who are not happy, try to look for what you really enjoy. So listen to your inner self and try to play, try to have fun, try to look for what you really like. And then if people really want to make their job out of it, I would say be patient. You can also jump, but then you risk to jeopardize certain things. If I would have jumped in 2014, maybe I didn't have the sufficient competence. Maybe I didn't have the network yet. So don't be afraid to take it slow. For me, it almost took 10 years to make from my passion my job. And I think nowadays, people expect things to go very fast. If you're hungry, you can order an app. You can use the app to order food. People live in a world where they think things happen overnight. But I would say be patient, stay true to yourself, and look for opportunities that connect to that. I think this is maybe a very cliche answer, but yeah, it takes time. Quality takes time. It's better to take your time and to become a healthy organization than to go up like a rocket and die out overnight.
Yeah. So you're more advising on walking step by step instead of jumping.
You can jump. I think some people, they jump, they take more risks. But me at that time, when I was also in this situation, I wasn't 20 anymore. I also had a certain quality of life.
Yeah.
I didn't want to jeopardize that. I enjoyed still traveling. I'm not saying I had a luxurious life, but I enjoyed my quality of life. And at that time, I always said I will only make the jump if I can have at least the same quality of life.
Okay, yeah.
This was for me the threshold.
Yes.
And it's not because we work with young people and we work on placemaking that we should pay ourselves less than a teacher or architect or any.
Exactly. Before we move to the last section of this episode, like 100 years from now in the future, Ram, what do you want people to read about you, to say about you, to hear about you when they see your name or picture?
As I try to make impact on people, for me, the 100 years from now is maybe not the most important. I think what people can find about you is, in a way, just the tip of the iceberg. It is maybe even superficial. So they might read things that are true, but maybe it doesn't really go to the core of my work. What I really enjoy, and these are also things that I don't always share with everyone in the outside world, is the direct impact we have on our young people. Because we do not only do placemaking, we also do youth work. So sometimes, and I won't say any names, sometimes these young people have issues. Serious issues, less serious issues. But we also try to help them. And then when a young person says to me, well, thank you, Bram, thank you, Urban Foxes, because without you guys and girls, I wouldn't be there anymore. Then I think, okay, you know, even if it's when we were talking about impact, just one person, if you can kind of affect this one person, this is very important. So I just hope that somehow I can push in this big lobby activity, our society in a way that we focus more on the importance of people in cities, the importance of the holistic approach, that we hopefully move away slowly. And I think throughout the 10 years, I have seen a shift already, that we move away from this kind of neoliberal approach to city planning to a more sustainable model of sustainability, co-creation, and healthy cities. If somehow I was able to contribute to that, even without any, let's say, accreditation, I will be happy. I think that's why we do it. We are aiming at future generations. Maybe when we say goodbye on this planet, maybe things, let's hope not, but maybe they're a big problem. But we hope that the next generations have it better than us.
Great. Bram. And in the final section of this episode, it's about also messages. So we close the episode. First is to yourself, like a message to Bram. What is your message to him?
Well, the message I would like to give to myself is that to find or to look at myself in a balanced way. I think we ourselves are our own biggest critics. I think in my case, it's also true. I'm quite perfectionistic. It also happens I'm not happy enough. So I would say, don't be too hard on yourself and also celebrate your victories, because I think this is something that we don't do often enough. Also with Urban Foxes, before you know it, you get used to things. You get used to winning projects. You get used to things. So I would say also celebrate the victories. And I would also remind myself, if this message is broadcast in the next month, is to also organize a big party for 10 years of Urban Foxes.
Nice. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So amazing.
This is on my to-do list to organize a big party to celebrate and to thank people from the last 10 years of Urban Foxes.
Yeah, because this will be out in March. So I think it's going to be also a great celebration from our podcast to you, Urban Foxes.
Definitely. Yeah, 10 years fly past. Yeah.
Yeah. And the three takeaway messages to our listeners.
When I look or what I would when I would address professionals, I would say, see the people you work with as experts. Experts of the territory, experts of the neighborhood. This is one takeaway. Like, don't act in any colonial way. You know a lot, you have been trained, but you don't know everything. So this is one. Another thing I would like to say is please use your creativity. It is good to look at existing tools for inspiration, but actually it's not that complex to create your own. Experiment, try something. So I would say be creative, experiment, find out. And the third I would like to say is to really focus on fun moments. Try to bring people together in a fun way. Even if the topic might be boring, I'm sure there is a way to bring people in a fun way to the table. So I think in this case, fun, if I have to make a formula for placemaking, fun, fun equals inclusion.
Oh, nice. That's actually true also.
Exactly.
Great. So the last question in this episode is going to be you asking it to our listeners and leave them to reflect. So what is your question to all our listeners, Bram?
The main question I want to ask the listeners is to reflect on the following question. How can we involve as many different people, as many different profiles, in co-creating our city? So in other words, how can we open the democratic process to these people to co-design and reflect on their built environment in another way than just to go and vote every 4 years? How can we really create this kind of co-creation?
Great question. Well, thank you so much. I'm really happy that we talked and explored more about Urban Foxes, what you do, the shift you did in your career, and about you, Bram, because you're amazing and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. It was really a pleasure, Mustafa. Of course, I prefer to see you in real life, but I really look forward to meeting again, having a drink together. And well, I'm also very honored to be part of your podcast, and I also want to congratulate you on all the years of work that you're doing, and I'm wishing you all the best for the next few months and years.
Thank you so much, and see you maybe in one of your favorite cafes.
Let's do that. Let's meet somewhere for cake.
Yeah. Take care.
Take care, Mustafa. Thank you.